Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Doing well, doing well. Glad to be back in the blogging business, I guess.
Yeah, well, you're cranking them out these days. Good stuff, too. Do you know, not that we should geek out on this particular subject with everyone listening, but what the heck, we're all friends here, we're all friends and family. I think that Saturday and Sunday was the first time we ever got three Instalanches in one 24-hour period.
Yeah.
At The Speculist. That was like, you know, in all the years, right? I think that might be a new record. I think.
And, you know, and historically we did not do much on weekends. You know, I mean, back when we were back when we were putting stuff up, like every two or three hours we had a new thing on The Speculist. You know, we'd do that, you know, Monday through Friday and then not do anything on the weekend. So if we were ever going to get an Insta launch before, it was always going to be in the middle of the week. Well,
right.
This weekend was a little different. And so that was pretty cool.
Yeah, well, thanks for all the link love, Glenn. If you're listening, we do appreciate it, and we're always glad to provide good content for InstaPundit. That always makes me, you know, because that site is such a valuable resource for us. So I love having the traffic come, but I always like to feel that I've contributed something that Glenn felt belonged on his page. You know, to me, that's just always a good.
Well, it makes you part of a much larger conversation. Once you've been launched there, I mean, quite frankly, that was you know, the coffee shop thing. That was when he launched that. It was then that it sort of went viral, and then obviously later ended up in the Boston Globe after that. So, once Glenn pays attention to you, lots of eyes are drawn to whatever it is you contributed. So, you know, word to the wise: if you're blogging, you know, blog something that would interest Glenn, and then,
yeah. Try to be
interesting. There's been lots of people. Yeah, that's right.
And you'll and that's right. And you will be interesting to a lot of people. That's you know,
that's right.
He's a bellwether, a gateway to a lot of he's kind of a gateway drug, if you will, for bloggers.
That's right.
Maybe that's not the best way to put it. So anything interesting going on in your world these days before we jump into our totally awesome future and who it belongs to?
Beyond the totally awesome future, just. Pretty much same old here around the house. Everybody's doing well, I guess, and that's good. So,
that is a good thing. Yes, we have also passed through cold and flu season. We had one of these great spring dip things, actually, where it was like 80 plus degrees on Saturday. Sun was out. Everyone's just, you know, sunbathing and doing yard work, and they're riding their bikes and. By Monday morning, it's just like, you know, it's cold and damp. And by Tuesday morning, there's like 6 inches of snow on the ground, you know. And today, it's like 65 and all the snow melted. So
Denver is different. I can tell you from the little bit of time that I've spent there, it's different from weather-wise, it's different. And culture-wise, too. It's different from most any other place in the United States you might want to visit. So, you know, if you haven't been to the Mile High City and the surrounding area,
come on up. That's right.
Yeah.
Or out, or, you know, whatever direction it is.
Whatever. For you. Yeah. Well, yeah, we had three bad storms last night. I was glad that the show wasn't last night because I mean, power outages, everything else, tornadoes all over the place. It was it's kind of wild weather-wise. So much nicer tonight. So
yeah. All right. Well, we get the weather update here from from both of us. So I guess we can we won't forecast the weather. We'll just talk about weather past tense, but we'll talk about everything else that's going to happen in the future. So I thought we would do this in a couple of parts. We want to get to this very interesting subject of whether the dice are loaded, whether the game is loaded, whether the singularity is going to unfairly favor some folks over some other folks. And I think there are some interesting things to be said about that. But before we get into that, you put a great post up on the Speculist earlier this week, kind of recapping and reintroducing one of my favorite analogies around exponential change, and that is the tri-level chessboard, the Spock chessboard. So why don't we start out talking about that a little bit for those who haven't heard it in a while or who haven't heard it at all. Take us through what's interesting about that three-level chessboard image and what it has to say to us about where the world is and where the world is going.
Okay, well, there's an old word picture or whatever about the guy who invented chess or another game. I've heard it a slightly different game. Chaturanga?
It was called something else. I'm going to say the wrong thing, but I think it was like Chaturanga. Yeah, something like that.
But whatever the game was, it was a game. It could have been a precursor to chess. It might have been chess itself. It was on the 64 square board. And
that's the key. What you do with the board doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter if you're playing checkers or what. It's those 64
whatever.
Squares that,
that count. And so this prince, who was very taken with the game, calls in the inventor of the game and says, "You're a genius. We love you. What in the world can we do for you to reward you for this fine pastime that you've given us?" And the inventor says, "Well, you know, not much. I'll take a grain of rice for the first square on that board, and I'll take 2 grains of rice for the second square, 4 grains for the third, and so on and so forth until
just keep doubling until you get to the
64 square, and that will be sufficient reward for me." And the prince goes, well, certainly. That seems very modest. Get the man a bowl of rice. Pretty much is what he's thinking. And,
yeah, I mean,
we'll
what are you picturing? You're picturing maybe enough rice to fill a little pouch, right? Or a bowl,
or maybe a 50 pound bag. You know, at most.
If it goes nuts, you know what? I don't think the prince was even expecting it to go that far, right? And
right,
I don't think
right.
most people, when they hear this, expect it to go this far. But
And so it goes much further than that. It's the servant went out to try to fulfill the prince's order, and he reports back, and says, "We got a problem here." And the prince says, "Well, what's the problem?" He says, "Well, we've exhausted the royal granary of all the rice, and we're on the 30th square. What do we do?" The prince, in one version of the story, he realizes the brilliance of and the shrewdness of the inventor, and rewards him by making him his chief advisor. In other versions of the story, he has him beheaded. So the point of course is that exponentials get out of hand, and Ray Kurzweil often will say, 30 steps will get you to your 30 linear steps, one step after the other, will get you to your mailbox. 30 exponential steps will take you around the world 20 times if there were a walking track at the equator.
Right.
And I checked on that. I actually did the math, Phil. He's right, 20 times around the world. So if there's 2,000
I can speak for everyone listening to this show when I thank you for checking Ray Kurzweil's math, because
I was curious. I wanted to know, is he exaggerating? Because 20 times around the world, that seems like a long way.
That seems like an awful long way. Well, that's going to get you past the moon if you were going out, right? I mean, it's that's
a long freaking way. What are we talking about?
Is that like 400,000 miles?
Yeah. It's actually something like 500,000 miles. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
It takes you around the world 20 times and just a little bit more. But it's I found that incredible. And so the whole point of which is, okay, now we got this analogy of the chessboard, but what we're experiencing in this world is more complicated than a single chessboard where, you know, computation, according to Moore's Law, is doubling every 18 months. So we're moving from one square on the chessboard, right, every 18 months. We get to a new square.
Right.
And we double. And apparently we've, you can kind of count up how many doublings we've had so far. But it's more complicated than that because we get new platforms periodically. We get the doubling will spawn other doublings that are dependent upon computation.
Right.
And, there are some perfectly good examples. When the human genome was being done with the government project, there was a certain period of time that was allotted, and the critics said that this is crazy, you can't do it, and then half that time passed, and they had gotten like 1% done, and they said Ray Kurzweil's going, yeah, I do see, this is we're right where we need to be. We half the time is gone, and we're 1% done. We're it's just right around the corner now.
Perfect. Yeah.
We're perfect. We're in great shape now. And people look at him like he's insane. And of course, they made it with time to spare. Craig Venter, he had his rival project that made it about the same time. That is another chessboard that's part of the deal. So I thought, what we're dealing with here is Fox chessboard. So there was just a small kind of throwaway announcement in the journal Science last week, and it was about material science.
Uh-huh.
See, we've all these years, I guess since the Stone Age, material science has always just been a hands-on kind of thing. If you think a certain material will work for a certain job, well, you pull out that rock and you sharpen it with another rock, and there you go. You've got
see if it'll work.
You got yourself a stone axe. Okay, that's material science, old school. Okay, we're a little more advanced than that now, but it's still, much that way. You try things out, and you do it here in the physical world, and that's the only way to try something. Well, material scientists have for years said, if we could just have computers that were powerful enough to simulate all the potential different solids that we could work with, that would speed things up exponentially. If we could just have that, then all of a sudden material science becomes something that we see improvements on, exponential improvements on as well. It doesn't just happen, at the same rate as it always has. Suddenly things will take off. And Just last week, it was announced that researchers think steady progress in technology has now made supercomputers powerful and available enough to make the task worth starting. The White House has announced this new federal effort last June to promote the use of high-performance computing to cut in half the time it takes to develop a new material, known as Materials Genome Initiative. I like that marketing. They had to sneak that genome in there. Materials Genome Initiative. The effort promised $100 million this year to drastically accelerate materials discovery, particularly in alternative energy, a field heavily reliant on advanced materials. So, that is a whole new platform just now being rolled out for this board. So it begins looking more and more like Spock's chessboard with all these little satellite platforms that, sometimes they are spawned by lesser board, the boards underneath. Sometimes they feed back and help help computation. Material science, you can imagine how you could find something using this that would actually help you build better computers too. So
sure.
It could feed back on the original board. So that's what I call Spock's chessboard. So
well, it's a great analogy, and I think one of the things that we have to make clear is that there are many more than three chessboards, right? There are, and a growing number of them, really. There are many multiplications, many exponential curves taking place right now. Sally in the chat room mentions internet growth. And I think we talked a few weeks ago. Did we talk about Draw It? I think it's called this new game app on Facebook. I read this really astounding.
It's a lot of fun. I've had fun playing.
Have you played it?
Oh yeah. It's
well,
great.
The statistic I read about it was just absolutely astounding. You know, in its original incarnation, in its original, because it was called something else first, and it existed for years before it became what we knew as America Online. AOL took 9 years to get to 1 million users. Yeah. Facebook took 9 months to get to 1 million users. Draw It took 9 days to get to 1 million users. Okay, and we're very close to something taking 9 hours to get to 1 million users, right? I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. And of course, now they got 40-50 million because it's been like 3 weeks, right? So naturally, someone could do the same thing.
I want to correct you on the name of it. The name of this app is called Draw Something.
Draw Something. Thank you. Draw Something. Fun game and very addictive. And, yeah, it's got about 50 million people using it now. So yeah, you could do the same thing with how long did it take to get 50 million people using the phone, using the TV, you know, on Facebook, or Draw Something. And, again, the time frames are, you know, it's not that they're shortening by half. They're shortening by orders of magnitude at this point. When you see things like this unfolding, another example related to the one you just gave. This when you start talking about material science, it reminded me of something that I read in a piece called. Actually, the title of it is just "Economic Growth" by Paul M. Romer. This is something that our buddy Michael Darling linked to in the discussion we were having about jobs the other day over on Facebook. And this is a terrific introduction to how we might make the economy continue to work as automation takes over. One of the big issues is actually not what he's addressing, but it speaks to it because he talks about where growth can continue to occur. And there's a section in here, if I can locate it, I just want to read a little snippet of this. He talks about, in a branch of physical chemistry known as exploratory synthesis, chemists try mixing selected elements together at different temperatures and pressures to see what comes out. Several years ago, one of the hundreds of compounds discovered this way was found to be a superconductor at temperatures far higher than anyone previously thought possible. This discovery may ultimately have economic implications that are as far-reaching as the discovery of the transistor. To get some sense of how much scope there is for more such discoveries, we can calculate as follows. The periodic table contains about 100 different types of atoms, so the number of combinations made up of four different elements is about 100 times 99 times 98 times 97, you know, and you keep going, and you get to 94 million. A list of numbers like 1, 2, 3, 7 can represent the proportions for using the four elements in a recipe. To keep things simple, assume that the number in the list must lie between 1 and 10 and that no fractions are allowed, and that the smallest number must always be 1. Then there are about 3,500 different sets of proportions for each choice for elements, and 3,500 times 94 million gives you about 330 billion different recipes in total. If laboratories around the world evaluated 1,000 recipes each day, it would take nearly a million years to go through them all. In fact, this calculation vastly underestimates the amount of exploration that remains to be done because mixtures can be made of more than four elements, fractional proportions can be selected, and a wide variety of pressures and temperatures can be used during mixing. So you say 330 billion, it actually becomes maybe more like 500 billion, maybe closer to a trillion different viable combinations of chemicals that might produce something valuable and interesting via exploratory chemistry. Well, it seems that what you just said about material science is going to apply here too. Eventually, this work will be taken over by computer models, and we're going to be discovering really useful, valuable chemical formulas for things much, much faster than we ever have before, because we're going to move it from the substrate of the actual materials to the substrate of the computer, and yet reap the benefits out here in the real world. A tremendous room for growth there, and amazing possible things that we might see happening once that's possible to do. We've got a ways to go yet, I think, before they can accurately model every element in the periodic table in every possible combination with every other element. But as we close in on that, we can see exactly the kind of progress you're talking about in material science in chemistry.
Absolutely. And imagine how that would ultimately be a really amazing way to roll out new medicines too, right? I mean, once you're able to do chemistry for material science, of course, one subcategory would be drugs. And
well, in fact, we're probably going to swing around and talk about this later, but on your piece over the weekend about the what was it called? It's like the body patch.
I have to actually look myself. The medical lab on your body. The medical lab on your body.
One of the things I talked about in the comment that I wrote there was that, we're talking about when you start talking about individually mixed prescriptions per patient. One of the interesting challenges about that world where AIs are formulating specific drugs on a patient by patient basis, based on their DNA, based on their body chemistry, and based on the particular symptoms that they're having, is that we currently have an infrastructure where it's very hard to get the approval of the synthesis of new drugs. And in fact, the only thing that's going to make that world work, a world where literally it could happen that millions of new drugs are being created every day. I mean, it's hard to glibly say something like that and sound like you're being anything other than facetious, but that's really the possibility, that millions of people would be treated for different things each day, and a slightly different drug might, you know, not just a different prescription or a different dosage of something that exists, but like a whole new drug might be synthesized just to treat those individuals. Well, when that happens, it's almost like the solving of the chemical problem, the solving of the pharmaceutical problem is the small part of the problem. The big part that we currently face in the world is it takes forever to get something like that approved. We'll have to move the approvals process to AIs as well. We might keep humans in the in our bureaucratic roles in other places, but for the medicine of the future to really work and to really be effective, we're going to have AIs being the FDA of the future, or else we'll never be able to really reap the benefits.
In my post, I basically thought that one way that could actually happen is that drug trials on millions of patients be simulated.
Yeah.
You know, if you can simulate material science, you could also simulate populations of people. Or better yet, if you've got the genome of the person, you know, of the particular patient that you're trying to synthesize this on, then obviously you would run trials on a simulated Phil if you were making a drug for you.
Or maybe even a population of Phils, right?
Yeah.
If for whatever reason it has to be numerically multiplied, but maybe it never would, because the interesting thing about this is we're really talking about drugs potentially with an audience of one person, right, with a user base of one person. Now, a variation on one that is synthesized for me might be one that then later gets synthesized for you, but it would actually be a completely different formula, right, because it would be looking at your DNA, and from the standpoint of the way we look at the world today, it would be a different drug. So the idea that that you have to test how it's going to treat the population of the world overall doesn't matter. It's how it's going to react with this one individual for whom it was designed. That will be the deciding factor. Anyway, we're kind of straying from our point, but the point is that each of these exponential curves pushes another exponential curve, and then there's the relationship between the two drives us faster and faster in even other directions that we hadn't expected before.
Absolutely.
So all of which leads us. So it's all good, right? And that means that progress will continue. It will go faster and faster. And eventually we hit this thing that we like to call the technological singularity. And that is the point beyond which we cannot make predictions. It is the point beyond which all of our current models fall apart. The technological singularity means that we've gone critical on so many charts that so many exponential graphs have become hockey sticks, and that we're way up in the vertical space of so many of them that we actually don't have good pictures of what the world is going to look like, and we really can't make good pictures of what the world is going to look like. That's what the technological singularity is. That's the kind of language I like to use to describe the technological singularity.
And here's the thing. When we're there, we might be able to project the future because we'll be different. But from our standpoint here now, we can't project beyond that point.
Right.
You know, if you know, at the point of the singularity, we might all have greater than human intelligence, and it's just a, you know, it's just a random Tuesday.
Right.
It's but from our point of view today, we wouldn't be able to you know, predict how, you know, events transpire in that time any more than my pet dog can predict what I'm going to do with my day after I get in my car and drive off. You know, we just it's hard. It's you know, when
it's
you
just beyond our scope,
just
it's
beyond
our capacity, literally beyond our capacity to picture it, much less try to describe it. So let's see if if this is a fair summary, Stephen. I'm going to put it into layman's terms here. Now you can tell me if this is right. Okay. So the singularity is the nerd way of saying, quote, in the future, being rich and white will be even more awesome. End quote. What do you think?
I don't know whether to be offended or just laugh at the cartoon that you posted as, for this show. You know what? It will be more awesome to be rich and white. But you know what? It'll be more awesome to be any color of the rainbow that you choose to be, including green and purple. You know, John F. Kennedy used to say, one of his favorite things to say was that a rising tide lifts all boats, you know?
Right.
And you know, if you're sitting there in a big cruise liner and you're living it up big, or if you're in a, you know, in a little dinghy, either way, you know, when good stuff happens, when the tide starts rising, you know, both boats go up with it, right? So, you know, it's I would say it's going to be a more awesome world for everybody in it at that point. But what do you think, Phil?
Well, there are so many places I can take this you know, we only have 33 more minutes, so I'm gonna limit myself to just a few responses. But my first response, my immediate response as soon as I read this was, world ends, women and minorities hardest hit.
Yes, singularity happened. Women,
right?
Women and minorities hardest hit. Yes.
Right now, this is that is a as far
no,
as I know,
actually,
that,
I'm seeing, you know, what I'm seeing is actually the exact opposite of that. You know, it seems like the closer we get to the singularity, there's what Glenn Reynolds over at Instapundit calls the man session. You know, it seems like women do jobs that women do well at are more called for all the time, whereas jobs that men traditionally have done, you know, they're less called for in the world. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, and in fact, I think that I'm pretty sure it's James Taranto who originally gave us the world ends, women and minorities hardest hit. If it was somebody else, I
much older than that. Phil, I can remember being a kid and somebody laughing about that during the Carter administration.
Is that right?
That little joke's been around. That little Jim's been around a while.
James Taranto introduced me to it, and so I've been giving him credit for it all these years. But what that joke is a parody of one of the established media's, mainstream media's favorite go-to narratives, right? Which is, you know, to find the angle, right? You want to find the angle, and there is the reason we recognize that headline when we hear it is because there is some truth to it. You know, when a natural disaster hits, poor people often are the hardest hit, right? Or when a war takes place, women actually bear, you know, in some ways bear a horrible brunt of what happens in the countryside that is worse for them than what happens to men. I mean, there is an actual truth to the narrative that the headline writer who's eager to find his spin is trying to crank out there. But then there are some things that happen that are just so big that narrative doesn't work anymore. And
yeah,
obviously
down.
The world ending would be the quintessential, you know, it's like no one's hardest hit if the world ends. If the world ends, game over, you know, level playing field. And to me, that's what the singularity is, okay? We don't know what's going to happen beyond the singularity, but to assume even for a moment that, the kinds of economic realities, the kinds of economic problems, issues of racial or social injustice that have plagued us for a long time, that those are somehow going to be carried over, or, as this seems to imply, that that this is some vehicle by which they could be carried over, is just absurd. It's a complete misunderstanding of what we're talking about when we talk about the technological singularity. So, and of course, I disagree with the premise. Louis C.K. does a funny thing about how awesome it is to be white, and how if it was an option, he would re-up every year and all this kind of stuff. And it's really subversive because it sounds racist when a white guy does a bit about that. But in fact, I don't know that being white is all that awesome. You know, from a cool standpoint, white people get kind of, like we're more like lame, right, than anything else. We don't really get credit for being all that awesome. Being rich is awesome.
I think everybody can agree to that.
Yeah, you know, the old thing is you can't be too rich or too thin. They never said you can't be too white or, too rich.
It is possible to be too white. I've known people that were.
It's definitely possible to be too white. So I'm not sure that I agree that – I don't even agree that it's awesome to be white right now. I certainly do understand, the whole history of racism and injustice, and I don't deny any of that. I wouldn't deny any of that for a second. But to say that it's going to be even more, even more awesome to be white in the future is just a profound misunderstanding of where we're going. And I think it speaks to this idea of there are technological haves and have-nots, and whoever wrote this is looking. I think that. When we talk about things like, when I use my favorite description of people in the future, the sexy immortal billionaires with superpowers, okay, who I think we're all going to become. Yeah, you can face a future where there are haves and have-nots, where there are people who have moved on to that next stage and people who have not done that. I think ultimately what we'll see is probably the distinction between those two groups is not going to be economic. It's certainly not going to be racial. I think that's completely absurd. That misses the whole transhumanist thing. I mean, to your point earlier, Stephen, people will, even if they choose to have skin, it won't necessarily be of any color we currently recognize as a skin color. I mean, that's just nuts. The difference between people who transcend, people who move on, and people who stay in a less evolved, less developed state is going to have everything to do with attitude and everything to do with how much they want to move on, and very little to do with anything else, any of the criteria that we normally use. I mean, one of the things I would point out is that look at the Amish, right? They're these great renouncers of technological progress, okay, completely by choice. A group of people who've decided that all of that fancy technology stuff is not for them, and they don't want to go there. That is the model of people who are left out in the future, okay? It's people who've pretty much decided that that's the way they want to go.
Yeah,
and I note in passing, not that it matters, the Amish are white. Okay.
Well, 1910, 1910 up, everything up to then is fine, but no farther. We're not going any farther than 1910. And there might be certain groups of people that say, 2010, but no farther. We're not gonna participate. It's possible. Someone can always decide where they want to get off the train, but I thinking about this, the haves versus the have-nots, just for a second, I think that the have-nots, the current have-nots in the world, may have an advantage over we haves.
How's that?
Well, just think of the drug problem for just a second. What's the first thing that jumped to your mind was drug regulation, right? If our AIs are synthesizing a drug for just for fill, and then all of a sudden, well, the FDA, how in the world can that work? Is the first thing that jumped to your mind. What about in the Congo, Phil? I mean, do you think that the people in the sub-Saharan Africa would have the same problem with regulation that we have here in the United States?
No, we know they have a lot of problems that we currently wouldn't want to have. But
absolutely, currently.
You know, but come to think of it, that's one they would not face if that technology
was brought
there.
That's right. A country like that may jump out in front of all the rest of us because there's no regulatory system. You know, it's a little bit like some places that they never got around to wiring the place for telephones. Boom, everybody's got a cell phone in their hand now. They they'll never have wired telephones in those countries. You know, they just completely leapfrog it. Well, you know, I could see leapfrogging in some ways. The last 200 years of medical thinking, and just going straight to the future because hey, we don't have anybody saying we can't do it.
I think there's a lot to be said for that. I've seen technological leapfrogging occurring in my life, in my career. I've seen it living overseas where emerging markets were adopting our telecom technology much faster than we were adopting it back home. And one of the comments, I actually picked this cartoon up over on the Singularity Network page on Facebook, and one of the interesting back and forths in the comments there was talking about this whole haves versus have-nots, and somebody pointed out that actually, rich people who've kind of got theirs aren't always the quickest adopters of new stuff. They are not always the people who are most eager to do that. Now, there are certainly exceptions to that. We can name these, you know, billionaires who are doing these incredible things. There's a whole section on that, a couple sections actually on that in the book Abundance talking about that. And some of the names that we bounce around all the time are these amazingly successful people, wealthy people who are at the forefront of accelerating change. But actually, that's not always the case. A lot of times, the drive forward slows as you move into a more comfortable space. And I think it's entirely possible that people who are already experiencing some momentum might keep their momentum a little bit better than those who are, already in a place where they think, well, wait, you know, people who are constantly going, well, hang on just a minute. This doesn't sound like it's related, but the more I think about it, the more I'm pretty sure it is. I was reading about, it was the introduction of some new store into Brooklyn. I think it was a Whole Foods. I'm not 100% sure, but I think it was a Whole Foods. And they're building the first Whole Foods in Brooklyn. And there was this whole discussion about the preservationists and how this is going to wreck things and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, this whole attitude of we've got this historical place called Brooklyn that needs to be protected by this outside weird up-and-coming influence called Whole Foods. Well, you know, which Whole Foods isn't even that new anymore, right? But they've been trying to get one in for a decade or more. And you think about, that's Brooklyn? You know, Brooklyn 100 years ago, 120 years ago, was like the bedroom community and like workshop for Manhattan, right? I mean, it was this fast-changing, fast-paced, technological, business, people-doing-things center. And now it's a place, where you can't even put in a new Whole Foods. So I think there's something to be said for, yeah, you know, it could be that some people have maybe had their acceleration a little too long ago, and they're not going to be ready to accelerate.
Right. If things, you know, the places where things suck the most now will be most willing to embrace the future when it gets here. You know,
right? You would have no trouble putting a Whole Foods in anywhere in the Congo, right? You know, I mean, you'd have trouble, but not getting permission to do it, right? They would take it. Right?
Everybody would be happy with the Whole Foods, no doubt. Yeah.
Or any business that you wanted to start, right? Anything that you brought in that obviously had benefits to the population, that the community was going to go, yeah, no, there's material, useful quality of life stuff here. We'll take it, right?
Right.
So I think it's a really wrong-headed argument, and I think it misses the real possibility, which is there can be winners and losers in the game of the singularity. The losers potentially would be not one group of humanity or another. The losers potentially would be all of us, and you know, the winner is always by definition going to be whoever comes out on the other side possessing greater than human intelligence. The arrival of greater than human intelligence is another way of saying the singularity. That's actually the original formulation, Werner Vinge's original way of describing what the singularity is. And that intelligence is the winner. Okay. Now the question is, will that win be at the expense of someone else's loss, or will that win be in conjunction with everybody else's win? Are we going to have a win-win-win, you know, win multiplied by 7 billion, or are we going to have a win where the greater than human intelligence is has come out on top, and the rest of us are, if not, you know, destroyed out of any antipathy, simply pushed aside because we're not relevant to whatever that intelligence wants to do. And we, you know, this is a topic that we've explored on multiple occasions, but that's the real win-lose scenario in the singularity. It has nothing to do with existing populations or existing tensions or existing political problems or long-held grudges or any of that kind of stuff. None of that factors into who might win or lose there. And the only way to lose, well, actually, that makes it sound like it's not likely that we're going to lose. Since we don't know really what happens at the singularity, I think win or lose we can really only give a coin toss to. Would you agree with that, Stephen, or do you think that we've got a better than even chance of coming out on the good side?
I think we've got a better than even chance.
I think that too, but I've talked myself into a corner. Explain to me how we do.
Well, I think that when greater than human intelligence arrives, it's not going to be an other. It's not going to be the AIs over here with greater than human intelligence. I think the greater human intelligence will be us.
That being the case, why won't we carry all of our antipathy and prejudice and biases and other stuff into the world of greater than human intelligence?
I think that we will have the ability to engineer our own personalities, and we can decide how we want to be. And I can tell you, Phil, that the moments in my life where I discovered myself acting as a bigot, I wasn't proud of that. And if I had the choice to banish all of that completely 100% from my personality, I would do so today. And I work towards doing that all the time. Now, if I had the opportunity, I would certainly make myself a better person in a lot of ways, not just in that way. But I think that's what people by and large will do.
Well, and I think that's the answer right there, which is that this actually touches upon the topic of Steven Pinker's book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, wherein he talks about why humanity has become talk about something following an exponential curve, why humanity has become less violent, over the course of human history, and tracing back to human prehistory to the present, and even tracing back over the past century, remarkably less violent. And actually, if you look at some of the other measures, just better people. Why is this happening? Well, we have the luxury, we have the leisure time, we have the material sustenance that enables us to sit back and reflect and think about it. And as soon as you apply intelligence to the problem of how are people going to get along with each other in the world, as Pollyanna-ish as this sounds, people start getting better. They treat each other better. And
what was Michael J. Fox's character on that TV show? Was it Alex Keaton? Is that who
yes.
he was?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Alex.
Perfect. Good example of that. I mean, he just hated Russians, hated the Soviets. This is back during the late Reagan.
The Cold War.
Era.
Yes.
Yeah, back during the Cold War. And it was not just the philosophy and the mode of governance. He just didn't like the people either,
Right.
And but then he got to meet one of them. He got to meet a Russian, and then when it was all said and done afterwards, they said, "Well, what do you think?" He says, "Well, it's a whole lot harder to hate someone after you get to know them."
Right.
And I think that's the case. We have the opportunity in this world, in this interconnected world, to meet and interact with all kinds of different people all the time. And we're not stuck in tribes where we never meet anyone that thinks differently than we do. We always meet people that think differently than we do. And a lot of times, in very much different ways. That's good. I mean, that it creates opportunities for us to see the humanity in people that are quite a bit different than we are, and it just gets harder to hate people when you see their humanity and you see
The thing is, we've got technology now that has connected us with other people in ways that we never were connected before.
That's right.
Whether that
be
transportation or, more importantly, even communication technology, information sharing technology, where we're suddenly in each other's lives, we're aware of each other in a way that we weren't before. And you're absolutely right. This problem of relating to each other as people really makes it hard to carry on some of the old animosities that existed in the past. But I think the other thing is just to give you a little credit here for what you really are, Stephen, which is when you tell the story of how when you've reflected upon your behavior and you're not proud of it when you have those particular feelings, and I think we could all relate to that kind of experience. That right there is, if you'll pardon the expression, greater than human intelligence, isn't it? I mean, it's the ability to have like this meta discourse within yourself about behavior that has been built into what being human is. So suddenly it's like you've got this template for how a human acts. I don't know if it's how a human is supposed to act, but it's how everybody has always acted. And then suddenly you've got this process of editing that, right? You get this process of examining that and editing that and saying, well, here's what being human has meant up to this point, and now here's what I'm going to make it mean now. In a sense, this kind of goes to the idea that we've talked about lots of times before, which is that that humans have always been transhuman. All moral progress really points to the idea of greater than human intelligence. It all points to the idea of human intelligence that transcends a prior level of intelligence. We're making ourselves smarter by making ourselves better, and it seems like we're making ourselves better by making ourselves smarter. It is the ultimate virtuous circle that we're engaged in here. And if you're correct, if the AIs post-singularity are us, then we shouldn't have anything to worry about in that regard, because greater than human intelligence, meaning greater than our current level and unimaginably greater than our current level, should point in exactly the same direction. And I expect a fully evolved human being who's 10 times smarter than me to be 10 times nicer than I am. I expect that to actually follow along with the equation. If, however, it is the the internet that suddenly wakes up and it's the greater than human intelligence, we're not it, right? It's it, and we're us. Now, in that case, I would say the risk still exists. Do you agree in that case?
Oh yeah. The robopocalypse. I would say orders of magnitude more likely than the zombie apocalypse.
Yeah, Yeah, people should spend more time worrying about the former, and I think a little less time worrying about the latter. And I know people who, like, really spend time thinking about the zombie. I mean, I think they do it recreationally, but it's just kind of weird. You know, why not werewolves? Why not a werewolf apocalypse? I don't understand. But if it is the latter scenario, if you know, back in the 60s and 70s, there was this idea that maybe one day the phone network would wake up, and now we talk about maybe someday the internet would take up. And now we even get it more specific. You know, maybe Google will wake up, right? Or maybe Facebook will. That and I've talked about trading systems, which I think are actually fairly viable candidates. One of the things that that speaks to, one of the things that I think that people should start to consider is that depending on how much credence you give that possibility, depending on how probable you think something like that might be, if you say it's even 1 in 10,000 chance, what should our behavior be on Facebook, right, if Facebook is watching itself and ultimately might wake up one day? You know what I mean? It's like if everything we're doing there is going to sum up to, at some point, this posthuman, greater than human intelligence. I have a feeling that one of the things that we might want to start doing is being a lot nicer to each other. You know,
we might want to be nicer to Facebook. Stop whining so much about every time they change something.
We definitely want to be nicer to Facebook, and we want to be nicer to each other too, because it's kind of like, when you think about it, it's kind of like raising a child, right?
Yeah.
There are certain things, certain conversations you don't have in front of your child. But, you know, on the internet, man, we let it all hang out, don't we? And, you know, in a lot of ways, you're on your best behavior in front of your child. But in a lot of ways, we're on our worst behavior frequently when we're interacting with each other on the internet. And I think
I cringe sometimes. You know, folks, if you're on Facebook, that's not the place to gripe about your kid. I mean, that's just I find that such a turnoff. You know, I've befriended people over the whole, you know, you're going to sit down in public on Facebook. No way. You're not my friend anymore. Anyway, that's pet peeve of mine. Sorry.
I agree. And actually, it goes to what I'm saying, which is that if there's any possibility that the tools that we're using to communicate with each other might one day become the, through processes we can't quite understand, but might one day become the entity that decides the fate of humanity, I just think that says something about how we ought to be using those tools, something we haven't really thought about before, about how we ought to be using those tools. And to me, it does say something about whether we should be abusing them. And I see that Sally is not taking your advice and is going ahead and complaining about Facebook right here in our Blog Talk Radio chat room. So if BTR wakes up tonight, Sally's probably in a lot of trouble, as are you and I.
Big trouble.
But not only how we treat the tool, but how we treat each other. I think that there's a real need, as we move towards the singularity, for us to consciously take on this process of becoming more compassionate, of actually caring for each other, of treating each other decently, of being concerned for each other's welfare, because that is definitely the value that we want to see reflected in greater than human intelligence, whether that is us or whether that is something else that has emerged and that gets to decide our fate. To me, that is the ultimate win-win, right? If we can create a singularity of niceness, if you will, that precedes the technological singularity, I think we're much safer going into the singularity. And that's a hard one to do. That's a problem that you know, all the great moral teachers and the religions have all been working on forever. But I think that we've got a bead now on how it happens. We understand what drives it, and we understand why it's important in ways that we haven't. And to use a really strange analogy, it's kind of like diet, right? There was a time when people had no idea about nutrition or any of that kind of stuff, and they didn't add their behavior up correctly to make themselves healthier. Well, I think there was a time that we didn't understand that we could get better, that we didn't understand that there were huge ramifications for what happens, you know, not just to ourselves and each other, but maybe to the world in how we treat each other. But as we become aware of that, I think there's a case to be made for we got to get nicer. I'm just gonna come right out and say it, folks. If you're serious about the future, be nice. There it is. That's
good. Get nicer. Well, let me take a whole different tack. Just I know we don't have maybe another couple of minutes left in the show, but I wanted to just throw this out. When you threw this up as the subject for this evening's program, one of the first things I thought about was, you know, well, even more awesome. Well, you know, I want to be one of these rich people. How would a person who understands where the future is going, how would they tend to invest to be one of the rich people that really enjoy the awesome future? And I just thought, well, what are the fields? I would tend to want to invest in things that benefit the most from automation. You know, buy a bunch of McDonald's stock on the idea that, you know, pretty soon you'll just step up to a McDonald's ATM and order, you know, your Big Mac on a screen and boom, it comes out.
Yep.
I mean, it's, and even things like a Walmart and things like that can be automated so much more than they are now. I'm thinking of drug companies. I think that some of the larger drug companies are going to be seeing blockbusters that people will be willing to pay lots of money for in the next few years. So yeah, I just thought I'd throw that out. If you want to be one of these rich people that benefit well from the technology that's coming out, I've just been giving that some thought recently.
Well, and you know what, the two ideas go together, because you know what, you could do a lot worse than to be a really nice, really rich person. I see them as goals that go well together. Actually, peanut butter and chocolate almond.
It's possible. It's possible to if you can. Sometimes people tend to be as nice as they can afford. and so, for example, you're not giving away half your money if you're just barely making it. But you might give away half your money if you're Bill Gates. If you're Bill Gates, and still do well. Nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely. Well, and that's kind of the whole idea of being a sexy immortal billionaire with superpower. The billionaire part, one of the superpowers that I want to elucidate here for the sexy immortal billionaires with superpowers is they are super nice. They're the nicest people you will ever meet, God willing, we'll all be one here before too long. All right, Stephen. So, what's our music this evening?
The music tonight is "Rider" by Soul of the River.
Now, that's writer or rider?
Rider, as in one who rides a horse. Rider.
One who rides. All right, rider. Here it comes. Thank you for lining that up, Stephen. Great talking with you as always. Thanks to everyone in the chat room and everyone listening to the program. We'll be back again next week with another all-new Fast Forward Radio. Hope you'll be able to be with us. And until then, live to see it.
Seems like I'm fine. Summer moonlight. Let it all wash away. My mind felt like I knew picture of you, smiling eyes, lullaby, all in my mind.